Welcome to another episode of the Weekly Crypto Check-In, recorded on July the 17th, 2024. I'm your host, Robert Swartha. I'll be joined by my co-host, Andres Sandate. How's it going, Andres?
Hey, Robert. Going well. Man, yeah. It is hot and humid here in Atlanta. How are you?
Doing good. It's been a while. We took a bit of a hiatus here between our two different travel schedules. It was tough to get together. So we're back at it, and we got a lot to talk about.
I was going to say, wow, it's been, to say the least, an eventful couple of weeks, but definitely good to be back on and good to see you.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, let's just dive in here. So first up is Morgan Stanley will be approving, supposedly, ETFs on their platforms for their advisors by the end of August. You know, this is, I guess, a bit of more of the same here as you start to see these platforms initiating the ability for their advisors to sell it to clients. It's not on the headline here, but I was reading yesterday that I think Wells Fargo is going to be around that same time. So, you know, the fall could be eventful or just more of the same, which has been kind of up and down in crypto the last 2 or 3 months. So more so down.
Well, yeah, more so down, right? If we're focused on the performance side. One data point I'll have for next week's call. Tonight, I'm attending a dinner in Buckhead with about 30 advisors, family offices, and one of the four fund managers that's going to be presenting in the dine around format is Bitwise, which, as you know, we've talked about this, is one of the initial issuers of the, you know, BTC ETFs. So I'm sure with the pending launch of Ethereum ETFs and this big approval and others in the pipeline, you know, it'll be good to hear Matt Hogan's take on, you know, flows into Bitcoin ETFs and other related crypto products, particularly from FAs over the next year or two.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, we've gone over this so many times, but it's surprised everybody. And I think another way to illustrate just how much it surprised people is kind of leads into our second point here. So the Bitcoin ETFs collectively are about $16 billion of AUM. Eric Balchunas, I always forget how to say his last name, but
from Bloomberg.
Yes, from Bloomberg. Yes. He has been all over the top of this and news reporting since January on these ETFs. As you know, his original projection was it was 12 to 15 billion for the whole year, and we are 6 months in and already past his upper end. So it will be interesting to see. Obviously, the price fluctuations in Bitcoin can affect that number greatly. Bitcoin's been, it's currently at 64,000 today. It's been all the way down to the mid to low 50s and all the way up to 70 in the meantime in those 6 months. So big percentage changes there.
Yeah. Well, he's gotten into the forecasting game now, and because the because the audience size is probably dramatically bigger than maybe some of his earlier ETF tweets and reports, particularly when it comes to social media, you know, outlets like X, formerly Twitter. You know, you put numbers out there in this asset class, and it just evokes a lot of reaction. So,
right, it evokes the emotional side of most crypto investors.
Curious what his prediction is on Ethereum ETF flows, which I know is our next topic.
Yeah, it's our next topic. I haven't seen him mention anything. Yeah, if anything, he's been, I think, learning along the way. He's obviously not a crypto expert, but he is either holding back or doesn't know what to say. And we could talk about that here.
Yeah, I think we talk about the next point, which is that ETH ETFs are expected to launch, you know, later in July, the 7/23. So, you know, I would love to hear, number one, your take on the timeline, because I know we saw additional comments requested by the SEC, but in light of what we just talked about with Eric B, we'll call him, from Bloomberg, I'd be shocked if the forecast or prediction is in the tens of billions. And I know we've talked about this offline, but, you know, how many people really are going to understand Ethereum relative to what they understand about Bitcoin?
Right. You know, I've often joke, advisors may or may not understand Bitcoin, but at least they know how to say it and spell it. Most people don't know how to say Ethereum correctly, certainly don't know how to spell it, and can't tell you what its good use, what good use cases are. There's a lot of learning there. There's no 30-second elevator pitch. There's a lot of things that we've kind of maybe brushed over in the past. As for where it could be at the end of the year, I've kind of told people to think about it. If you look at the ratios of market cap of Bitcoin to Ethereum within the true crypto market, eventually I could see it mirroring that within the ETF market. Not in the short term. Say Bitcoin is at 20 billion by the end of the year, if Ethereum is, 3 to 5 billion, I would be surprised. I just don't see where the demand is going to come from and why they would want that. Besides this, they just want some diversified quote unquote exposure. Besides just holding it at Bitcoin ETF.
Yeah. And, I haven't followed this particular launch as closely. How many issuers are bringing ETH ETFs out?
Eight or nine applications. I don't know if they've all made it through. I haven't paid close attention to that part. As of today and tomorrow, as of today, they're supposed to be filing their final S1. So we'll get tickers. We're going to get fees. We're going to get the things that people probably truly care about.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to remind people, like, this is exactly the same kind of product that the Bitcoin ones are. Just a different asset underneath the hood. It's still cash create, cash redeem, a redemption. And there's, in this case, there's also no staking allowed with the Ethereum. Yeah. Which is the big piece that admittedly should have happened. Hester Hirsch.
That means there's not a yield play, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so they're purely just like, You're diversifying away from Bitcoin potentially into having two, but basically their function is following the same music. So, Hester Peirce was quoted yesterday. She's one of the commissioners of the SEC, was saying how, she's always open to the idea of evolving these products to being, to change the cash redemption so it could be in kind, or allowing, in this case, Ethereum to have some the ability to do staking and then they have a yield on it. That's not going to happen with the Biden administration, I'll say it right now. So maybe things are different come January, and we can start having those conversations. But right now, that's a non-starter. So
right. Well, seriously, a lot of questions with respect to the ETF and like what's the next 6 months look like. I think we have that in general with the election and just all the uncertainty there, and ongoing developments, but also with respect to the ETFs. Yeah, you would think an advisor that wants to recommend an allocation to crypto is probably going to be asked by a client, like, I heard about ETFs, I've heard about Bitcoin, I've heard about Ethereum, like, do we need to do both? Advisors are going to need to be thinking about answers. So lots of stuff to resolve.
And admittedly, they have a lot of education that they need to do. In I guess I wouldn't say short order, but they need to get on it at some level because their younger client base is going to be the ones asking about it. The older ones,
that's right,
not as much. So
Our
fourth point, kind of shifting gears a bit, is the FTX estate. So this is, FTX is going through bankruptcy. They filed in late 22, early 23. And the attorneys apparently have gotten enough fees out of this, so they're ready to start doing distributions. And they are going to be distributing $16 billion in cash. It's a lot of money. Obviously, this was money that was willing to have crypto exposure before. That's literally what it was. So it'd be interesting to see what the markets are like when that happens. Sounds like it's coming soon. And, $16 million is not a huge amount of money, but in the crypto space, it can start to move some particular tickers, probably less so for the tokens like Bitcoin, Ethereum that are the higher market cap, but who knows where that cash goes. Some of it may be going into another estates that were in bankruptcy because of this too. So it can be locked up. So, maybe we'll never see the true effect of it, but I thought it was cool to see that at least dollar for dollar, we were in a bear market at that point. People that had assets on FTX are getting their quote unquote money back. They didn't get to participate in the roughly 4x upside that crypto's had since then, but they also got made whole. It's just this weird world of how wildly asset prices can change on something. Because it's not typical in the real world. So
yeah, my takeaway from the $16 billion distribution headline is number one, I think everybody would probably vomit if they saw the amount of fees that were paid to yes. all the various parties that needed to be involved in the bankruptcy. Like you said, the lawyers, the accounting firms, the valuation firms, the bankruptcy yeah. advisory firms. I mean, it's probably pretty sickening. And then there's been a lot of horse trading and just really betting on the bankruptcy itself by a lot of institutional investors who, you know, who bought claims for pennies on the dollar and are going to make, you know, they're going to make good money on those bets. Now they, unlike a retail investor who had $5,000 or $10,000of retirement assets or savings parked, mm-hmm. they have capital and time, and arbitrage is a mandate that they can go and buy this. So yeah, there's a lot of angles here that you could dissect this, but yeah, mm-hmm. I think one good takeaway is, you know, for that investor that had money tied up and it was frozen, yes, the opportunity cost, but at least they're getting some dollars back that were originally right. put in place in terms of their principal.
Yeah, I mean, and admittedly, if you really do the math, yes, they were able to claw back some assets and liquidate some assets that FTX owned themselves to kind of get to this number. By also waiting and kind of allowing the fees to accrue of sorts, the market corrected enough to be able to allow them to sell some of these assets, some of the tokens to get to this number. So, you know, it's a double-edged sword there, but it's, you know, fascinating to kind of watch because it's, again, it doesn't happen in normal bankruptcies. You get pennies on the dollar, you don't get made whole. So,
right.
Yeah. Our next topic is back on the Gensler SEC lawsuits thing, but this one's different. This is Coinbase has filed suit against the SEC to get access to Gensler's private emails because they don't feel like what he's saying publicly and what he's writing privately are the same. Yeah. My guess is, you know, this there's nothing public that said this. The first thing I thought when I read this headline was, somebody's a mole somewhere and somebody said something, because why would they have a basis to even like go after this? Like somebody had to have tipped them. And it does seem probable. So it'll be interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's a point in their finger in the chest, if you will, of, you know, the agency and the agency's de facto face and its leader, at least for now, right. Through the end of this administration. As is typical, as you outlined yesterday. So look, throw the haymaker, see where it lands, see how it lands. And I just think it's fascinating. I mean, these lawyers that are working on behalf of Coinbase, and I'm thinking the lawyers sitting there at the SEC and their counsel, it's like, I know all these people play golf together on the weekends. Right. You know, it's just, it's maddening. But here we go. That's the way it is. It wouldn't be a crypto update with Teton unless there was something in there about Gensler. You know that.
Yeah, and that's just the state of crypto. I dug real hard to find something.
I know. So, well, the House of Representatives failed to override the veto of SAB 21.
Yeah, they bumped it 2 consecutive days, the votes, and then it didn't happen. I mean, admittedly, I think it was maybe a little bit too optimistic to think that they could override it. Cause they had a majority before, but they didn't have a super majority they were going to need this time to get it done. So this is something that, you know, again, if there's a new administration come January, this is probably one of the first couple things that probably gets cleaned up. Would be my guess. So, this, I guess more so sharing it here so we could tie a bow on it for the time being. We've been talking about it was coming, but, we are, going to have to wait a little bit longer.
Well, to suggest that there haven't been major political and, you know, events happening in D.C. with the assassination attempt on Trump and now the RNC, all the talk over the last month about is Biden going to stay in the race? Like, it just seems like many things came to a halt with respect to momentum, maybe that we thought we were going to see at the beginning of the summer. I mean, there's just a lot that's transpired over the last month. So
yeah, absolutely. And this vote happened last week, so this was predates the assassination attempt. But you know, it does seem like the momentum is a little bit slowed. I think part of it is because Congress is back in their districts; they're not actively doing anything, so there's less stuff getting drummed up. It'd be my read on the situation.
So. It's getting close to August, right? So we're like deep into the summer, and mm-hmm. yeah, when they get back from fundraising recess, it maybe it rears its head again.
But again, then we'll truly be in the depths of a political season from there till November. So
sure.
You know, at the end of the day,
so Goldman, yeah, this next one, Goldman Sachs, obviously, you know, when a firm like Goldman Sachs, a sort of traditional Wall Street investment bank, launches three mm-hmm. tokenization projects, that's a worthy headline.
Yeah. So threw this in here because not because they're saying specifics about it, but just more so just showing that, like, you know, some of these well-regarded firms, as you were mentioning, are really starting to like talk publicly about things that they're thinking about and trying to do. I'm sure more details will come. This, I believe this is supposed to happen in late Q3, early Q4 is from my reading. So we got a ways to go, but like my guess is it follows a similar model that you're seeing JP Morgan do with their crypto. They're trying to tokenize bonds. They're trying to tokenize different kinds of other assets. They're playing around. I mean, they're trying to figure it out, and more credit to them for doing that. And obviously they're trying to figure out how they can be relevant in this new world by being, I guess, yep. a hub or a marketplace for this stuff. As much as crypto can just be a marketplace anywhere on the internet. But I think a lot of this is still, you know, to be part of it, you have to be on, you know, in JP's case, you got to be on their platform. You have to be an accredited investor, and it's probably still select accredited. It's probably not full open to everybody yet.
But yeah.
It's cool to see them talking about it publicly. You know, you hear rumblings about them trying things. You see job postings where they're talking about new crypto experts. It's like, well, they're doing something if they're hiring these kind of people.
Right. But right.
It's hard to see them come public about it is great.
Well, yeah. One thing about the, you know, the likes of a Goldman, they're, you know, their employee headcount, I haven't looked,
it's huge.
You know, recently, but it's not only is it huge, but the number of folks in technology roles in engineering and in mathematics and in, you know, areas related to AI and quant, machine learning, data, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of people probably think about a Goldman Sachs as a traditional M&A shop that arranges, you know, financing, takes companies public. And certainly, you know, they're high up and always have been for it seems like eons when with respect to the league tables in traditional investment banking business. You know, they tried to go into wealth management. They tried to go into doing more consumer related financial services. That didn't work. But I think in this area, given the just the human capital and all those areas I mentioned, I wouldn't be surprised if we continue to see a firm like them try to really get deep in, like a Citadel and others, just because of the number of securities and other asset classes that are going to get tokenized, right? When you think about their clearing and custody and related businesses, all the swaps, so. And they're a truly global firm. So once right. institutions start to do more in tokenization and in crypto and digital assets, you got to think that, you know, Goldman Sachs is going to want to be right in the middle of it. So,
yeah, well, it'll be fascinating to watch. And, you know, I just think it's, you know, an interesting thought experiment from time to time is like, it's great that they're doing this. What firms are not doing this or not, or way behind the curve? Will they get left behind? Will they, how will finance look different in 10 years? Not just because blockchain exists, but like, is there a reshuffling of names, the big mm-hmm. names, the small names, all that kind of stuff. So it's a yep. bit of a pivotal moment, I think, for the finance industry. And I think most of the big players are starting to realize that, but maybe, you know, some others will have to play some catch up. So. The next topic, kind of on the spirit of experimentation, is an airline based in South America. I believe their name is Flybondi. I believe it's an Argentine airline, if I'm not mistaken, has started allowing people to, when they buy their tickets, get an NFT of it. And that allows them to sell the NFT and do other things with it. You know, the first thing that came to mind is like, if you can change the name on an airline ticket, like, this kind of puts us back in the world pre-9/11, where you could walk up and hand cash at the counter at the airport and get a ticket and jump on a plane.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit different. I can't see this being rolled out immediately here in America. We have admittedly more restrictions, good or bad, there at the airport. But it's just cool to kind of see it showing up. You know, you can get reward points. There's all sorts of things they're trying, and again, they're experimenting. So
right. Well, and you know, it sort of challenges the fundamental premise of I bought the airline seat, so mm-hmm. I bought capacity on
right.
the airplane.
Yes.
Because I can't make it, why should I not be able to transact with somebody who can make it? It's like correct. A concert ticket. I bought a ticket to a concert. I can't attend. There's mm-hmm. now a market for somebody else to go and attend that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, oversimplified, but nevertheless, yes, a lot of questions around regulation and being able to substitute a passenger, safety, et cetera. But fundamental concept is they're just creating liquidity around a fairly illiquid asset, like capacity on a plane that a lot of people want to be on.
Yeah. It's be cool to see how that one evolves. So our next topic, and I will say up front, I'm going to try my best to try to keep politics out of this podcast for the next 6 months.
Good luck.
Yes. Yeah. It's tough.
But
I think it's important to kind of bring in. I'm bringing this point up because you're seeing such a difference between the way the Democrats are handling crypto and the way the Republicans say they want to handle crypto. The Republicans really haven't had a chance outside of when Trump was in office before, and it was too, in my opinion, too nascent to really like do much about then. So you have, you know, Trump obviously selected his VP candidate and J.D. Vance.
Right.
J.D. Vance has got quite the track record when it comes to crypto. You know, he voted to repeal Saab 121, so that's pretty recent. He has been very critical of the SEC, which is admittedly easy to do, over the debt box incident, which is when they were lying to the court, and they got sanctioned for that recently. And he introduced a bill to improve bank regulations, which I only think can be better. They've gotten pretty terrible for crypto companies with regards to traditional banking. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I guess he also, I mean, he wants to see.
He's a former VC as well. So, I mean,
VC, right? Absolutely.
Yeah.
He's got, so, I mean, from a tech interesting intersection. Yeah. So.
That's right.
And then he also holds, at least on his disclosure, about $250,000 in Bitcoin. So there's obviously personal motives to see it go up. And maybe that's why he cares about those things. But it's, you know, Trump is going to be one of the keynote speakers at the Bitcoin conference that's happening this week in Nashville. Among many other big names, admittedly.
And Trump's campaign, I mean, announced, I think it was earlier this week, that they had raised 20 plus million in crypto donations. So, yeah, I mean, you're right. Like, it, when you hear the narrative around digital assets and crypto, the Republicans seem to have taken the mantle. Mm-hmm. They are out front. And I think there's a lot of voters who are paying attention to that, particularly, like I said, the younger ones who tend to be, by and large, you know, larger holders, may not have many assets in crypto, but as far as participating in this asset class, certainly more, you know, more active.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a, you know, and I guess to be fair to the Democrat side, I will say that Trump, his, SEC chairman, so that would have been Jay Clayton. He's the one that started the lawsuit on his second to last day or last day in office against Ripple. So there's some negative there. Maybe they were personally motivated, but at the end of the day, it's I can't, you know, in hindsight, I was excited when Gensler came in because I'm like, this guy understands crypto, and it could not have gone any worse. Well, I guess it could have. It's hard to imagine it, but maybe it could have. But we are potentially looking at a different environment come next year. So depending on how the
election is. Well, my only other, a lot does depend on the election. Clearly, when it comes to crypto, I think the next 4 years are going to see even more change. And I would say the consequences and the opportunity versus the prior 4 years are even more. More are likely to have more of an impact on the future of financial markets, capital markets. And I think that the leadership in DC, the leadership in the regulatory agencies, and that obviously starts at the White House and their posture, is going to dictate a lot. You know, that there's all, there's always that saying, you know, people underestimate what someone can do. They overestimate what somebody can get done in the short term, and they underestimate what they can do in the long term. And I think when you think about crypto and digital assets with respect to this, you know, second to last point, I think we're all totally unaware of the impact crypto, digital assets, DeFi, et cetera, is going to have on the economy in the long term. It's just getting there. Seems like we're not making the quick progress. And so I think whichever party, whichever leadership, whichever agencies decide to step forward and think about it in a sensible, progressive way, they're going to write history. So I think the next four years are going to be big.
They could be. And I will say, with the caveat that admittedly, it has to be not the Democrats moving forward for the next 4 years in control.
You hope that, we don't see four more years of what we've seen, right? Which is enforcement by regulation and go offshore, and we're going to try to score political wins in the near term to move voters, but then really have no appetite for innovation when it comes to the executive branch. So, which would be bad, you know, for the space.
For sure. And, you know, I've heard rumblings of, you know, if it's another four more years of what we currently have, a lot of crypto companies will be planning packing up and moving offshore and just kind of riding off the U.S., which is pretty sad to think that in a technology, you know, U.S. is largely viewed as a technology country. Like, we can somehow get our shit together. So,
That we would miss that opportunity to lead this industry.
Right.
Yeah, for sure.
Cool. Well,
our last one. I was intrigued when you put this in the update, so I'm going to let you talk about it, but I'll read it. So, is the Bitcoin security model broken? A headline, a sort of a theoretical question. Yeah. Tell us what you're thinking and what the implication is here.
Yeah. So, Bitcoin is an asset that largely is viewed as a digital gold. So it doesn't really do much. You can transact in it, yes. But it's not efficient for that. There's better networks. So we'll set that aside and say that's not really the point of it. Up until this point, the way that miners get interested in running their hardware and doing all the hard work that is the Bitcoin, running the network, is they get rewarded for it. They get rewarded in fees. They get rewarded in mining new blocks. Well, as the block reward becomes smaller and smaller, you know, every 4 years, we just went through one in May. So we have another, call it 3 years and three quarters left of this current, you know, reward cycle. The amount of Bitcoin that they're mining, you know, the price needs to functionally double every 4 years to keep up with the curve that the miners need to stay on just to buy hardware. So they're not actually making any gains. They just needs to double every 4 years. Okay. That has happened in the past. It has done way more than that. At some point, those curves are going to cross, right?
Yeah.
And then it becomes truly fees. The miners could decide that, you know, they're not willing to do the work. So that starts jeopardizing. This is where the whole word security comes in that phrase. The whole security model is the network's highly secure because there's lots of computers doing lots of math. They're competing for the same rewards. At the end of the day, if there's less competition, there's less security. Does the network find a way to evolve out of this? Like, I don't have an answer for this. I'll admit upfront, but it's food for thought of like how different networks have been architected since Bitcoin came out. Bitcoin was the first one, so it's enjoyed all those advantages. Other networks that come along that haven't had the advantage of being first, but they've had the advantage of seeing how they might do something differently.
Yeah,
how they might innovate. You know, for fees and just a lot of other use cases. You know, for the biggest asset in the asset class, I don't even know what the current percentage of the total market cap Bitcoin is, but it's probably still over 50%. It starts to make you wonder. And all the Bitcoin proponents, they're like, oh, we need people to buy Bitcoin. I'm like, why? Like, is it just because you think it's going to appreciate? Is it purely like price go up, so I must buy type mentality? Or is there other reasons? And, you know, at some point, does this become a bag nobody wants to hold? I don't think we're anywhere close to that, but I wouldn't say that's off the table. So long term.
Yeah. It's a question about if I sort of paraphrase liquidity, in this case, security, and the benefit that the technology promises is anonymity, decentralization, digital gold, etc. But without participation in that market, you lose those benefits.
Correct.
And in the case of a buyer and a seller, we saw what happened in 2008 to asset prices when, right, there was no bid, asset prices cratered. So they popped back over time as buyers came back in and eventually said, you know, these prices are too beat up, i.e. stocks are too cheap. We're going to start to buy again. But think about how many people had stayed in cash since that correction. We talked about, you know, the couple earlier, because it was their life savings that they saw, you know, go 30, 40% down, and they just kind of panicked. So you've got to have liquidity in functioning markets. You've got to have regulation to a certain extent. And you've got to have the in the case of Bitcoin, you've got to have the market participation.
Yep. And, you know, because that's a true marketplace. You know, there's the miners on one side and there's the users of the network on the other. And, you know, they kind of in some ways need to be like in a harmony of equal amounts and all that
stuff. Right. Yeah.
Awesome. Well,
well, I don't know. Maybe we need to take 2 weeks between these calls because there was a lot to cover. But I guess the takeaway is we'll see you next week. I'm you know, if it's like anything last week, there's going to be a lot more to talk about.
Yeah. Well, hopefully we have it's a little less dramatic over the next week. It'd be great. Oh, so,
say the least. Yeah, for sure.
Well, thanks for joining us on this episode of the Weekly Crypto Check-In. If you want to stay updated on future episodes, you can find us on any podcast player by searching Teton Crypto Capital or Weekly Crypto Check-In. Take care.
Take care.